So our next speaker is Bob Barron, who is Vice President at Sensory Spectrum, Inc., a 30-year-old consulting firm specializing in connecting sensory and consumer insights to drive business success. Bob works closely with clients to create tailored research solutions for their product challenges. He also works very closely with the consultant teams to broaden and promote the company's diverse capabilities. Prior to joining Sensory Spectrum, he spent 15 years at Mars Chocolate North America, where he led sensory and consumer insights, product development, and innovation teams. Bob and his teams worked across the entire product lifecycle from ideation to commercialization to launch new products and ensure the quality of market-leading confectionery brands. Prior to Mars, he worked for an ingredient supplier focusing on the use of high-intensity sweeteners in foods. Bob holds a PhD in food science and technology from the University of Tennessee. Bob will share with us today the business case for taking Sensory global. So please join me in welcoming Bob.
So welcome, everybody. I want to thank both ASTM and SSP for inviting me to speak today. My speech is really going to be on business case. So I'm not going to get into the meat of different methodologies or how we do things in global research. Mine is really to talk about where are we at globally and what's happening right now and over the last couple of years. So that's going to be my speech. Let's see if I get this thing right. So here's my agenda. Basically, I'm going to go back and talk about historical regional organizations. I was involved in several of those, and there is actually bias there too. So I'll talk a little bit about that just briefly, historical regional organizations, then the changing environment. So what has happened in the past that really changed us into this more of a global approach, why it's important to us that we develop this type of research and really start thinking globally, and then we'll just talk a little bit about the journey so far, what I've seen in my experience working in different companies and now consulting in that area. And then summary closing, and we're actually gonna save questions till the end, so we won't do questions there. So as I thought about this, you know, I was asked, hey, can you come in and do this business case discussion on Sensory Global? I thought, well, let me kind of reflect on that and go back and really think about my history. So it's the 10th anniversary of SSP. I was fortunate enough to be one of the keynote speakers 10 years ago. So I thought, well, let me go back and think about what things were like 10 years ago. So you probably can't read that, but that's actually, I went to the SSP website. I'm getting a lot of echo here. Move over here. I went to SSP website, and I actually pulled off. That's the first page of the conference program. So right off the bat there, we can see that probably half of the people on that don't work where they worked then, so that's 10 years ago, me included. We've all changed jobs, we've retired, we've moved on, we've doing different things. Sadly, there's a couple of folks on there who were great Sensory colleagues of us, leaders in the field who are no longer with us. So sadly, we've got some of that. But the message in creating the future, so here we are 10 years later and we're still creating the future. So that's great, but that's a great message. Some of the other things that were going on, interestingly, at that time is we were right on the edge of a global financial crisis. So we weren't so much thinking about it. There were some trickles coming in, and then it was really starting to hit. So we know what that did to all of us, really changed the way we operate, changed the way we think about things. We had just elected the first African-American president in the United States, so I don't know if you realize this, but the conference actually started the day after Election Day. So I remember sitting in my hotel room, watching the returns come in, the reception at Grant Park and all of that. So it was a very interesting time. The iPhone was less than a year old. So think about that. This amazing device that has changed the world, changed my family and my children dramatically too. Now we're on the iPhone X Plus Max, whatever it's called now. So we've gone through all of that. Amazing thing. And then some real history that went on. Beyonce and Jay-Z got married 10 years ago, so that was really important. social media was just emerging, right? So we have, if you look at these slides here, these things didn't exist, or they were in their infancy just 10 years ago. Netflix started streaming video. How many of you remember? We actually used to go to a store and get a video and take it home and then forget to take it back and pay huge amounts of fees on it. And we don't do any of that anymore. We just pull up Netflix and there's everything we could ever want. What else? And globalization at that point. So at that point, I was still in an organization that was just starting to talk about globalization. So that's some of the things. And then just to make myself feel a little older, I thought I'd go back and talk about my journey in sort of going towards globalization. So to make myself feel older, I went back even further and I said, okay, let's talk about my career. So 1995, I'm fresh out of graduate school. I go to work for a sweetener company, big, giant, global chemical company, but we didn't operate as a global organization. I operated in my regional organization. We just worked regionally. And some of the biases I'm gonna talk about in the next slide actually came out there. So one of the funny stories I tell is we used to transfer products back and forth that utilized our sweeteners. So my German colleagues kept sending me this beverage and saying, this is an incredible beverage, you should taste this, show it to your clients, and then maybe eventually we'll sell it in the US. And I was like, oh, this is horrible. This thing tastes terrible. The American consumer will never drink this. Well, that product was Red Bull, so we know how my bias worked out there. Then I transitioned into, again, a global company, M&M Mars. And again, big global company, but we operated regionally. We didn't share that much, and there was sort of a push like, yeah, maybe you want to harmonize. And we were like, yeah, you know, that's hard to do. Maybe later. The one area that we were pushed on because we were privately held is the owners had some passion around a couple of different chocolates. So they were like, yeah, you got to make sure those chocolates are pretty much similar around the globe. So we did a little bit of work on that. And then I remember in about 2008, Ward Spears, who worked with me, Ward and I get called to a meeting, say, hey, come to the meeting and bring all that data you have on those global chocolates. All right, so we prepare our presentation, we go. We walk in the room and they say, oh, here we're gonna introduce you to the new global segment. So we went from regional organizations to global segments. So now the global segment was the chocolate segment. It was headquartered in New Jersey for the globe. There were global research centers. All of that was happening, and that's when it really happened for us. So now it wasn't, yeah, see what you can do to harmonize. Now it was like, no, you have to harmonize, because now we're going to be basically operating as one global organization. We're going to standardize lots of stuff. So that was a big change for us. So that's kind of what happened. So that's my history a little bit, the background of how I moved into globalization. And so let's talk about that. So regional organizations, what was it like? So what were the reasons? So I went back and I said, what were the reasons that we kept this sort of or regional organizations? Well, back, if you go back pre-internet, pre-email and stuff, it was hard. It was hard to be a global organization because I couldn't just pick up the phone and if I had a rotary phone, God help me, because it would take me like a week to dial Europe. So it was difficult. If I needed to do something, I had to get on a plane, travel. Again, there was no, you know, global travel agency and stuff. It was just a lot harder. So that was one of the real reasons we kind of kept regional. It was just easier to do that. It was also expensive because, again, you had to, you know, you were less productive. You were moving or you were traveling, all of that. There were a lot of things around tariffs and duties, so you couldn't easily transfer raw materials around. That got very difficult. And then there was a lot of different regulatory. So the biases, though, so those were the real ones, the real reasons. The biases we had were things like the methods aren't transferable. You know, we do this method, you do that method, it won't work, let's not do it. Some of the other biases were language differences are difficult. And it's true, they are difficult, but they're not insurmountable. There's ways around that. We've worked in lots of different organizations. We've had interpreters. We sit down and we work through. We call it this. What do you call it? Let's come together on that. So you can do it. Raw materials are different. Yes, raw materials are different, but again, there's methodologies you can put in place to make sure that your raw materials from all different countries are similar. So I was just talking to somebody earlier, you know, there's varietals that come from all around the world, and you can, there are ways of measuring that and seeing how they are different and how they're similar. And then the belief that products must be tailored for that region, and that's my Red Bull example, right? I was like, you know, American consumers will never drink this stuff. And again, we see how that worked out for me. So good thing I wasn't an investor at the time, because that wouldn't have worked. Okay, so again, I said sort of that reflection point for me was around 2008. So what was happening at that point? So what was driving the difference? What was the changing environment? And these are just some of the things that I put up. Again, you might have run into different things in your organization. Your timelines may have been different than what I'm talking about, but just in general, that's kind of the view that I wanted to take. So we had growth of global brands and global products. So we started to see companies say, you know what, I'm going to start to sell my products globally. I think I have a great product here. I think it's good. I'm going to start to sell it globally. We had increasing global trade. So about that time, lots of trade deals were going on. I know maybe not now, but you know, it was at least at the time, lots of free trade, NAFTA, lots of things were going on there. So I'll talk about a couple examples of that. Move into developing countries. So developing countries, developing markets. So at the time, we talked a lot about BRIC, you know, so the BRIC countries were big. And if you looked in, I went back and looked in several annual reports. It was in annual reports that this is gonna be a great growth opportunity for us. I know it was in all the documentation we had at Mars at the time. That was one of the things that we were looking at. Technology, as I already mentioned, you know, lots of changes there that were really driving globalization, making it much easier. So taking those hard things off the table and making it much easier. And then consolidation. We'll talk a little bit about that also, and sort of the change in businesses and the consolidation we're seeing through mergers and acquisitions, and then going to shared services and a lot of the things like that. And that is driving globalization also. So let's move into that growth of global brands. So here's just a couple of examples. There's way more. These are brands that intentionally are saying, yes, we're gonna sell this product globally, and we want it to be as similar as we can make it. May not be exactly the same, but the goal is, if I have a Coke here, and I go to Africa and I have a Coke, it tastes the same. It has the same view, it has the same brand message, all of that stuff. So we see that. And these are just a couple. I worked, you know, specifically on Snickers for many years, and I can tell you there was a huge amount of energy that went into making that thing taste the same, have the same texture, have the same brand message around, you know, hunger satisfaction, and you're not yourself when you're hungry, and all of those things. So there's two ways of looking at that. So it's, I am intentionally putting product in the market that I want to be saying globally. And then there's some that are more around global products that are maybe the same, but may have different names or whatever. So this is just a little video. Do we have audio on this? So this is just something I pulled from BuzzFeed. So this just talks about, maybe not. I guess we should have tried this ahead of time. But this talks about different products. So it starts off with, let's see, Burger King in this country is called Burger King. In other countries, it has a different name. Axe is an Axe product. It's called Lynx in other countries. So we kind of go through that. So I guess this isn't going to work. All right. Well, we'll move on. Yeah. But this, yeah. If anybody wants to see, I'll show you later if you want to see it. Or you could just go to BuzzFeed and look at it. Just talks about how there are lots of different products globally. One that I can talk about specifically on the chocolate side was Galaxy is a chocolate that is sold in most of the world. And in the US, it's called Dove. And there's some reasons for that politically and all this stuff. But I will tell you, starting probably about 8-9 years ago, they really went to harmonize those products. So if you taste a Dove chocolate here, Originally, it didn't taste anything like Galaxy. Galaxy was very milky and sticky and sweet and caramelized. The product in the U.S. had a little more chocolate essence to it, so it was different, but the decision was made, no, this is a global brand, global product, so they've changed those formulas. So if you have the Dove chocolate now, it doesn't taste like it probably did 10 years ago. So, change. Increase in global trade. So I just went back and I pulled a product off of that global products list. So Nutella. So I'm using Nutella. I'm not picking on Nutella at all, please. Ferraro, don't get mad at me. All I did was pull this off the website. So this is just literally their nutrition facts and ingredient list. So this product shows that it's made in Canada. The one that's in my pantry is made in Mexico. So products made all over the place. The interesting thing, though, I just pulled out the different ingredients. So sugar, where does sugar come from? Well, it comes from lots of places. But if I'm making it in Canada, I'm probably getting that sugar from South America, Central America. The U.S. sugar is kind of a protected commodity, so it's not easy to get it in and out of the country. Or out of the country, I guess it's already in the country. So it's probably coming from there. Hazelnuts, if most of you don't know, the majority of hazelnuts are grown in Turkey. Also, because of the popularity of Nutella and other hazelnut products, it's almost impossible to get hazelnuts. So all the hazelnuts in Turkey are often spoken for, and now they're grown in Washington State. A lot of those are spoken for too, but they're coming from somewhere other than Mexico where this product, or Canada where this product is made. Palm oil, the major producer for palm oil is Indonesia. Again, there's climate, things that you have to take into account where you can grow palm oil. And cocoa, most of the cocoa in the world comes from Africa. Again, it's limited in where it can grow. And then even the packaging material, PET, major producer of PET is China. So here's a product that I go to the supermarket and I buy that is amazingly comes from everywhere. So, you know, global trade has made that happen because a company wouldn't do that unless it was profitable, right? So there's a profit there that they're making, even though they're sourcing from all around the world. Another way of looking at it, so that's my car, a 2014 Ford Fusion. Please don't judge me. There's a website you can go to and say, hey, where's my car made? So I had no idea. I just went to the Ford dealer in my town. I bought a Ford Fusion. Well, amazingly, my car was actually assembled in Mexico. I didn't know that. Only 30% of the parts come from the U.S. or Canada. The engine was actually made in Romania, and the transmission was from the United States. So again, another look at, here's a huge, large, global organization that can now pull in what they need to all around the world. So here we see, this change in sort of increasing global trade. Lots of other examples of it. Move into developing markets. I mentioned that earlier. So we have those BRIC countries and things like that. So this is a slide similar to what Susan had shown. So this is just a measure of the middle class. So this is a projection of where the middle class is going to go in up to 2030. And you see massive growth. If you look at the top bar, that's the U.S., North America. Really, you don't see a lot of growth. You actually see it shrinking, the middle class there. But in areas like in Asia Pacific, huge increases in the middle class. And middle class here is defined as daily expenditures of $10 to $100 per person, according to the parity of the finances in those countries. But huge growth. So right there, what does that tell you? Well, I want to play in that area. It's important for me to be in those areas because these people have buying power now. And I want to sell them stuff. Another way of looking at it is this is GDP. So GDP is, again, a measure of your sort of economic output of your country. So we see in 2007, at top, US, then EU, Japan, Germany, and then China was number 5. If you go to 2050, again, this is a projection. But if you go to 2050, we see that China is number 1, US. Then we move into other countries. We have India, we have Europe still there, and then we have Brazil coming up. And if you look at like things like, where's my little laser? Is that my laser? the green, there we go. So we look at Japan was number three here in 2007. They move all the way down to here. So again, big changes in the growth of those areas. Also, for any of you who travel globally, you know, you've seen these kind of things. I'm in some, you know, small village somewhere, and I can buy a Coke. I can find Coke products. I could find other products. So you've all seen that. The ones of you who have traveled internationally, you kind of see those things where it doesn't matter where you're at. I can buy these brands all over the place. One of the more interesting ones recently was this one. So this is Starbucks moving into Italy, which I thought they were already in Italy, but not realizing that this was a huge deal, right? Italians drink more coffee than anybody in the world, and they are passionate about it. So they saw Starbucks coming in as just a total terrible thing. This was a terrible thing that this could happen. So what did Starbucks do? They said, okay, we're gonna humbly, Howard Schultz said, humbly, we're entering the Italian market, and here's how we're gonna do it. This is not your standard Starbucks, right? It's this beautiful, it was a post office, a beautiful building, right? And then they put this gorgeous thing in there, and they have a roaster in there, so they're actually roasting beans in there. They have a bar. So what you don't may not know if you don't go to Italy is most of the coffee is just consumed at a bar. You walk in the morning, you order an espresso, you stand at the bar, you have your drink, you leave. Not like here where you're laying around and some of the crazy things you see in Starbucks now where people basically live there. They don't do that, right? So here's Starbucks saying, I'm going to move into this area, this country that I know I have to change things. So this gets to a message I'll talk about later. We have to be flexible, right? So why did Howard Schultz and Starbucks decide to move into Italy? Italians consume a huge amount of coffee, right? That's why they wanted to get in there. But they couldn't come in and put up their, you know, 400 different Starbucks, and it just wouldn't work. So what did they do? They modified it. They made some changes so that they can make it in that market because there is a big part there that they can make money, and they modified their business to do that. So it's just another one, that maybe not moving into a developing market, but just moving into another market in a different way. So let's talk about technology. Well, technology, I already talked about it. Email, instant messenger, join me, Skype, all of those things. I remember 10, 12 years ago sitting in conference rooms with these huge, big, you know, cameras and TVs and stuff, and nothing ever worked. You know, the companies would spend thousands and thousands of dollars, and you would sit there and, you know, the picture would be all broken up and you couldn't hear the people and all stuff. Now I can take out my phone and dial up somebody on some app and have this wonderful conversation globally, somebody halfway across the world, seamless. Yeah, in the Starbucks, yeah. And it's amazing. So the technology has really been a big enabler of globalization, and you just see it happening. Trade, again, we have companies like Amazon and Alibaba where, again, I can buy a product from anywhere in the world and it'll be at my door in a couple of days. What else? The internet, obviously. Advertising, so you can, again, go on the internet and look at advertising from anywhere around the world, products from anywhere around the world. It's just opening those up. And if they're interesting to me, I go to Amazon and I buy it. Right? It's all sort of seamless. The amount of cloud-based computing and cloud-based apps is just amazing. And then the last one is consolidation. So what do we have in consolidation? So this is just a little funny thing. So consolidation, we've seen mergers and acquisitions. We see driving scale and efficiency. Global procurement is another. Consolidation we've seen in sort of reducing headcounts and giving people more jobs. But, you know, sort of the Dilbert boss says, hey, we're consolidating our marketing into a shared services model, and I'll talk about shared services models. And the intern says, why are we doing that? Well, it creates the illusion that we have a strategy and gives our CEO an excuse to fire a VP who beat him in golf. And blah, blah, something about money. Well, it's everything about money. It's not something about money. So let's talk about mergers and acquisitions. These are just a couple from this year or in the last couple of years. We've got the Heinz Kraft purchased by 3G. So again, we all know that story and what happened there. Amazon purchases Whole Foods, and there's a whole list of them. CEOs were quizzed, and they said, 69% of CEOs said, yeah, we're going to do some level of mergers and acquisitions this year, which beats a record last year. So last year was a record for mergers and acquisitions, and we're going to see even more this year. Probably have already seen a lot of them. What does this tell us? That companies are looking to innovate, they're buying innovation, they're just trying to move into new markets. It's easier to just buy into a new market than to develop that. So again, one of the drivers for globalization. Example here is through the centralization, so the idea of centralizing. Basically, Unilever has rolled up all, they had a lot of different ice cream brands, they rolled them all up into one brand, this sort of heart brand, so that's the heart logo that you see, so there's still lots of different brand names. They consolidated all of their headquarters into Italy. Global headquarters for ice cream is now in Italy, and they consolidated into 16 plants worldwide, which was at one point much larger. Why did they do that? Made sense for them to drive that into the global markets and to be more efficient and save money. Marketing is an interesting one. So we see that now we've moved to global marketing. So what used to be, I'm in the Northeast region, and I worked with a lot of New York-based marketing ad agencies, things like that. So there's been a lot of consolidation there globally. So now I can get in touch with one advertising agency, and they can enable me throughout the globe because they've gone through consolidation too. A lot of mergers and acquisitions there. They can also take advantage of production cost changes, savings, right? So I can produce a commercial, and maybe I'll show it to you, but maybe it won't work. I'm not sure. I can produce a commercial in one country that's relatively inexpensive for me to produce it, but then I can air it in every other country, so it saves me a lot of money. The shared services model that Dilbert, the boss at Dilbert, talked about, that's where you see HR, finance, and IT. So when I was at Mars, if I needed help desk help for my computer, if I picked up the phone during the day, I talked to somebody in Brazil. If I was at home in the afternoon, I talked to somebody in Australia. And then there was another time frame where I would get somebody from Asia Pacific. All consolidated, answering calls from all around the world, just depending on what time zone you were in and what time zone the IT people were in. Same with HR. I used to have an HR person that was part of R&D that helped us. Now it's a shared service. It's just you get on the phone, I need some HR help, it's done that way. So why do they do that? Well, it's a headcount reduction, it saves money. So I'm not sure this will work. Wow. Okay.
You look delicious today.
Delicious?
Let me go back for a minute. So I'm gonna show you two commercials, right? And of course they're M&M commercials because that's, you know, I have to do that. They hold my pension, so I have to promote them every now and then. So you're going to see two commercials, exactly the same, that can be aired in two different countries. So here we go.
Wow. You look delicious today.
Delicious? Honestly. Sometimes I think you only like me because I'm an M&M's.
That's not true. Maybe what matters to me most is what's on the inside.
I'm pure milk chocolate on the inside.
And I love that about you.
And here I thought you loved me for my brain.
Is that made of chocolate too?
Gosh, you're handsome.
Okay. So let's go here.
Te ves deliciosa.
Deliciosa. ¿Por qué tengo la impresión que te gustó solo porque soy un chocolate M&M's?
Eso no es cierto. Lo que más me importa de ti es el interior.
All right, so that one's not going to work, but you get the idea, right? So there's one production, paid for one production, and I just dub in new languages. I also can do voiceovers. So if you ever remember this, you remember the Mentos commercials? They were probably the most corny, goofy commercials you ever saw. With some crazy situation, and I have a Mentos, and now the situation is solved, and then I say, you know, the fresh maker, and I hold up the thing. It's all done with voiceover. So a lot of those commercials were produced in Germany or Austria, and then just shipped around the world. It's done with voiceovers. You can change the language, you can change the taglines, all of that stuff. So one way of doing that. So here we are. I talked about the changing environment and what I thought were some of the key things that really have sort of moved us into globalization. So growth of global brands, increased global trade, move into developing countries, technology and consolidation. So why have we done that? Why has this happened? It's very simple. It's all about money, right? And when it's about money, money's gonna win. Sadly, I hate to be the cynic on this one, but if in large corporations, they can see that you can save money, you can get into new markets, so it's both top line and bottom line. I can sell more, and I can save more on the bottom line through raw materials and through some consolidations and things like that. So where does that put us as sensory scientists, as sensory and consumer researchers? So where are we? So I looked for sort of an analogy of where are we at? So we're being asked by our organizations, by our clients, hey, I need you to be more global. I need you to work globally. So I thought this is a good analogy, the International Space Station. So it's a fine example of global collaboration. It was 15 different nations got together and said, we're going to build this research center, lots of cross-functional folks involved, and pieces didn't always work. I remember I don't remember exact countries, but let's say Japan built one of the modules and the U.S. built the other module. When they were supposed to connect together, they didn't connect. They were just misaligned the way they connected. So what did they do? They found ways around that. They developed it, they communicated, they made sure that they shared specifications from then on, and then guess what? They developed this wonderful tool for the advancement of science. So much like where we are at right now, and that we're driving us to be more global, what are we gonna do? Well, we're gonna have to collaborate cross-functionally, we're gonna have to work together, we're gonna have to be flexible and advance the science. So, what have we seen progress so far? So, Gail and I kind of talked about this a little bit and what we've seen over the years and what we're seeing now. You see sort of three different models, right? So we see fully harmonized, not a huge amount of the businesses that we deal with, we see that. They're fully harmonized. They're using the same methods, same language. They're working globally. They have global teams, they're communicating. And even in some cases, in many cases, the team is managed in one country, managers in one country, the teams are spread out in all different kinds of countries. So we don't see that. Then you see partial harmonization. Oh, and the one thing about the fully harmonized is a lot of times they either picked a method, said, hey, this method works for us, let's do it, or they developed their own. So it's a hybrid of maybe two or three different methods, and they made that. Partially harmonized, so again, see somewhere in the middle, and then we see ones that are just not harmonized at all. They're just not ready to go there. They don't have the energy to do it at this point. So now what? Well, globalization's here to stay, right? It's based a lot on money, so it's here to stay. So what does that mean for us? Well, we can lead in this area. We can stop complaining and bickering and getting in our little silos and saying, I didn't invent that here, I can't do that, I don't wanna do it. We have to get beyond that. We have to appreciate diversity. So we just heard that in the last speech. This is a huge, important part of it. Appreciate diversity, be open to those biases that you have and work around them, retrain yourself, be open, flexible, and willing to try new approaches. So again, we can't just be digging in the trenches and saying, no, we're not gonna do that. And just look for opportunities to create together. We've seen that in several of our clients where they've actually been able to work globally and actually create something new. So it's not this method or this method, it's sort of a hybrid of something in the middle. And always, communicate, hugely important, and now much easier with technology, and then keep science in the forefront. That's always should be what we look for is we're scientists, we should keep science in the forefront, okay? And that's all I have. So thank you for your time, appreciate it.